Okay, I wanted to try to talk about patterns, patterns that occur in physical systems and biological systems, as mentioned. And I want to do it from the point of view of a mathematician. So a couple of years ago, when faced with thinking through what is in pattern formation, I happened to be at a conference in the Newton Institute in Cambridge. And there were a number of people from different fields, mathematics, physics, biology. And so I went around and asked them, well, why do you study patterns? It was a conference on pattern formation. And I thought I would start with some of the answers that I got. The first one is that they're just pretty. And just to try to drive this point home, here are pictures of mud plains. This is this occurs when the underlying geology, the rocks are drying, and you get this pattern forming. Well, we'll come back and I'll show you a little bit more. But notice it's a kind of hexagonal structure, and you see the same kind of pattern on leopard spots. And if you want to go into a laboratory, this is an experiment on convection. So it's just a fluid layer. It's heated from below. And as you raise the temperature on the bottom, the heat goes from being conducted straight from the bottom to the top to convective motion. And the picture that you see here, I think the dark spots are where the fluid is flowing down, and where it's light, it's flowing up, or the other way around. But I think that's correct. And again, you get this hexagonal array. And of course, in a controlled experiment, this is much more convincingly hexagonal. There are other kinds of patterns, which I'll call stripes, and you see here in these sand dunes, you just get these linear array of patterns. See them in zebra stripes, and again, in the experiments, under different parameter values, you get convective rolls, as they're called. Now, something that's going to be very important for this talk this evening is that I want to talk about patterns that are not just stationary. All the pictures that I showed you were just of stationary patterns, but ones that have motion, and yet there's still a kind of pattern that's involved. I have a colleague, or had a colleague in Houston, in the physics department, Mike Gorman, and for many years he's worked on this pattern-forming experiment, which is a porous plug burner. You have gas and air and fuel just coming up through the burner. If you look down on the top of the burner, it's just a circle. It's just a circle. So the whole thing is circularly symmetric. And you start getting flame fronts. So the fuel goes through, you ignite it, and the flame just sits up there. The little line is supposed to indicate the flame front. And you get pictures like this. So again, a pattern. Now, in dynamics, here are some of the things that Mike finds. What can you change? You can change the flow rate, you can change the fuel, you can change the stoichiometry, that is the leanness or richness of the fuel. And when you do that, you start getting... What we would like to do in the mathematics is understand where do these states come from. And I won't give anything away by saying some of the states that you saw in Gorman's experiment from a mathematical point of view, we still don't understand where they come from, even though they look very regular, very symmetric. It's a bit of a puzzle. Okay, so that was one thing. People look at these patterns, they're just pretty, and you'd like to understand what's going on. Then the physicists all seem to say, they like to use the word emergent phenomena, self-organizations. So by that they mean that the physical processes which go on, which are in play to make these patterns, are on a micro level. Yet you see the pattern appearing on the macro level. So somehow there's a phenomenon that's occurring. It's hard to understand, certainly technically, mathematically, how this happens, where you go from something that looks homogeneous to having a structure on a big scale. And you saw those in the pictures, you know, sand dunes, mud plains. These were on enormous scales that you were seeing these patterns. The other thing that the physicists like to say is that the patterns have a function and that there's science behind these patterns. So let me try to explain what I mean by these last two. Well, okay, here's a pattern which we use a lot in society, a lot more these days than before, but it's you have the pattern has some relevance, which has a function, and we know what to do with it. In order to get at the science, I want to use these columnar joints, it's hard to see here. They're really almost, again, hexagonal arrays of columns, if you take a cross section. But if you want to look a little, these things occur around the world. Here is along the Snake River, the same formation. But perhaps the best way to see it is on the Giant's Causeway in Ireland, where when you can look down on the top of these columns. And again, you have an array which reminds you of the mudflats, same kind of pattern. Well, Steve Morris, who is responsible for giving me these pictures, is an experimental physicist at the University of Toronto. And he and a graduate student tried to do an experiment which would explain where these columns come from, or at least from a physical point of view. So what they did, they got this mass of cornstarch, and the cornstarch, they wetted it, so it was a uniform, just flat surface. Then they brought in the sun, well, two suns, and they dried the cornstarch. And what they found is that depending on, you could arrange the rate of drying by how high the sun of the lamps were above the cornstarch, and there was a range of heights on which you would get this pattern to form. So the pattern had to do with the rate of drying in the substance, and then you could see it. So from the physics point of view, this is telling you something about where the patterns come from. Now, to kind of segue into pattern formation from the more mathematical way, is that, I mean, a lot of applied mathematics is about creating models for a physical situation and trying to see whether those models are accurate. They describe it either phenomenologically or, better yet, numerically accurate models. Well, changes in patterns can give you a way of testing models. And there's a really wonderful example of this coming from the Navier-Stokes equation. So I've written down these formulas, and I don't know how many people in the audience know what the Navier-Stokes equations. I know there's one person. They're Newton's laws for fluid motion, and that's all you have to know about them. They're some complicated partial differential equations. They were written down by Navier in 1821, and then re-derived by Stokes in 35 years later in 1856. But it wasn't until some experiments and theory done by G.I. Taylor in 1923 that the first experimental confirmation of the Navier-Stokes equations took place 100 years after they had been written down. So that gives you some idea of the pace of science sometimes. Okay, so the experiment that Taylor looked at was the so-called, what is now called Couette-Taylor experiment. You take two cylinders, put fluid between them, take water, and rotate the cylinders. Now you can rotate the inner cylinder, the outer cylinder independently, The first thing to do is let the outer cylinder be fixed and just rotate the inner cylinder. When the inner cylinder is going very slowly, the fluid is just moving around in circles. The fluid particles are just going around in circles, and the speed depends on how far it is from the boundary. As it gets closer to the boundary, it's going around faster. If you speed up the inner cylinder, there's a transition, this Couette flow, which is completely patternless. And this is another issue. We don't see this as a pattern. We see this as a pattern. And let me just comment on this in a moment. When this transition takes place, you see this very symmetric Taylor vortices take place. In other parameter regions where the outer cylinder is going in the opposite direction from the inner cylinder, you will get these spiral vortices. And as you can imagine, with the spiral vortices, if this thing's rotating in the lab, what you don't see is this, but a barber pole. The fluid just looks like it's running up, and it really looks like it's going to come out the top, which, of course, it doesn't. The wave is traveling up, not the fluid particles. So you get these different kinds of states. But there's a transition from Couette flow to Taylor vortices, which, to use another theme that's going to come up, breaks symmetry. This has less symmetry. When I can translate this up and down, forgetting about the top and bottom, this you can only do discretely, discrete translation. So it has this Taylor vortices has less symmetry than Couette flow. Okay, so what Taylor did was compute the transition between Couette flow and Taylor vortices. It's a big calculation done on computers now routinely. You could assign it as an exercise in a numerical analysis class, and the computer, any desktop or this laptop would be plenty fast to be able to do this. In 1923, Taylor was doing this with hand calculations. So it was really quite a tour de force. The dots are experiments. The bold line is the theory. And what you see is the transition from Couette flow to Taylor vortices occurs spot on. And this was the confirmation that the Navier-Stokes equations were a good model for what was going on in the fluids. Now, Taylor was a very good and honest experimentalist. Notice that out here, the transition from where Couette flow loses stability is not where it's theoretically predicted. And the reason is something else is happening, and I'll come back to that. Okay, now we get to the reason that I would like to study patterns. Patterns formation can be associated with symmetry breaking, this breaking of symmetry. And the mathematics that's behind symmetry breaking can create a menu of patterns, a whole list of different kinds of patterns. The physics, biology, chooses from this menu. And what I want to do is describe a little bit about how this menu is formed and what information you can get just by knowing that there is this menu of patterns. So we'll see, as we've seen, you can get stripes and spots, the hexagonal array in planar systems, and the oscillations with circle symmetry. I'd like to look at those. Okay, so Euclidean symmetry is translations, rotations, reflections of the plane. Suppose that you have a state which is invariant under all of these symmetries. So if you were thinking of the convection experiment, before you heat the bottom of the fluid layer, you look down, everything looks completely uniform. And you could imagine translating this around, forgetting about the lateral boundaries. If you ask the question, well, what kinds of states will you get on breaking, symmetry breaking from these states as you vary a parameter? Well, in the case of the convection experiment, it was the temperature on the bottom of the cylinder. Then theorem, you can get stripes or spots. Those are the typical states that you would expect to see. And of course, this is what we've seen in so many, in those pictures that I was showing. Now, change the geometry go to think about Gorman's experiment where you have a circularly symmetric apparatus, then we ask the question, well, how many different types of oscillation, like that rotating wave, can you get from a state which is just completely symmetric, circularly symmetric? What would you expect to see? And the claim is, the theorem says in that case, that you get two types of time periodic motions. You get these rotating waves where time evolution is the same as spatial rotation, or you get standing waves which have fixed lines of symmetry. So to recall, in Gorman's experiments, you have these rotating waves. And the thing is that they, if you look at it, it is they're just uniformly rotating in space. So the dynamics is coupled to the symmetries. And that's why we call those things spatiotemporal symmetries. The standing waves, which we saw, have these lines of symmetry. Now, if you go back to the Taylor-Couette experiment, Andrek, Liu, and Swinney 20 years ago looked at this in detail. And this was the range of parameters that Taylor was considering. And you go from Taylor vortices, from Couette flow to Taylor vortices. If the outer cylinder is counter-rotating a little bit, then Couette flow will lose stability to those spiral vortices that I showed you on the first slide. Now, those spiral vortices take the role of the rotating wave. The symmetry is in the axial direction. The theorem says, this menu, that there's another state that one should see around here, and that state was called ribbons. It has these lines of symmetry. Andrek, Liu, and Swinney had never found this state, but just by applying this menu, then going back to Navier-Stokes equations and trying to see if there are parameter regions where the state occurs, it did. So you can start to make predictions about states that you can actually see in the experiments just from having this pattern. Okay, so let me try to summarize what I've said in the last couple of minutes. The mathematics of pattern formation leads a menu of patterns. That's model independent. It just depends on the symmetries in the system. And then the physics and biology choose from that menu of patterns. And that choice depends on the particular model that you would look at. Okay, so now let's go on to something that's a little bit more animated, and that is the way that four-legged animals move. So we have up there a picture of a Siberian suslik. I'm sure everybody knows what that is. Bounding, and maybe I should start with me first of all. When I walk. If I were to swap my legs, I would be a half a period out of phase from where I am. So I don't know if I can demonstrate. So if I swap my legs, I'll fall over. But if I go a half a period, notice my legs are in the opposite orientation. So there's a spatiotemporal symmetry in gaits. The bound is one where the front legs come down in unison, the rear legs come down in unison, and a half a period out of phase. So it's front, back, front, back, front, back, front, back. That's the motion. Now, elephants amble, horses walk. It's just this thing in English. But they're exactly the same motions. Figure out what this elephant is doing with its legs from this picture. I'll come back to it. There's a much easier way to explain what's going on than to actually look at the sequence of pictures. Now, trotting, you know that horses trot and they pace. Trotters move their diagonal legs together, so the right front, left rear move in unison, the left front, right rear move in unison, and they're a half a period out of phase. Got that? Because I'm going to show you a movie of a horse trotting and see if you can pick this out. Okay, how about slow motion? If you look, the right front, left rear, left front, right rear, right front, left rear together, left front, right rear, exactly a half a period out of phase. I got this off the web. This horse was rather expensive because he was such a good trotter. And you get this motion.
Okay.
So I promised you a way of describing the walk. A four-legged walk, on like the quadruped, is left rear, left front, right rear, right front. Left rear, left front, right front. Almost exact quarter period phase shift. You don't believe me, go to the zoo. Well, it may not be open just now. But it really makes the zoo a different experience. And you can get one and see how. So we talked about trotting. Pacing is a kind of military march. Both left legs, both right legs, both left legs, both right legs. Pronk. The first thing that people often say is that's not a word, but there it is. It's a word. What pronk is, all four legs together. So little deer will do this. Actually, big deer will do this when they're startled, and it's quite dramatic as they go motion. Then there are the gallops, which I won't really talk about, other than say there are gallops. Pronk. Well, it took a long time to get a picture of a pronk, but there it is. So, okay. Ian Stewart, who found that picture, and Jim Collins some years ago started looking at animal gaits from the point of view of spatiotemporal symmetries. So let me try to explain what they had in mind. The three gaits, trot, pace, and walk, really are different gaits, and they can be distinguished by their symmetries. So in the case of a trot, remember diagonal legs moving in unison, if you swap the left legs and the right legs, you swap the diagonals. So they're half a period out of phase. So swapping left and right is a half period out of phase, just as the walk. And the same thing would be true of actually of all the other gaits. The pace, the left legs are in unison, the right legs are in unison, a half a period out of phase. Swap them, you're a half a period out of phase. Okay, but if I take the front legs and swap them with the rear legs, in the case of a trot, the diagonal swap, so you're half a period out of phase again. But in the case of the pace, the left legs and the right legs are synchronous. When I swap them, exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same gait. Modulo, a question of whether it's going forwards or backwards afterwards. But anyway, the motions are going to be described the same. The walk is swap left rear to left front to right rear to right front, and you're a quarter period out of phase. That was the description. So these gaits can be distinguished by their symmetries. Now, there's a little thing here. These gaits are different. Well, you say, of course they're different. But let me explain what a biologist might mean by them being different. Biologists are great at doing these kinds of experiments. You take a dog. Now, little dogs like to trot. They don't pace. And so you put the dog in a halter so that it's constrained that it has to pace. And you leave the dog in this halter for an hour or two, a day or two, a month or two, 6 months. And then you take it out of the halter. So it's forced to pace. Once the trot is forced to pace, take it out of the halter, and within one or two gait cycles, it's trotting again. It doesn't want to pace. It really is biologically somehow a different gait. There's a different wiring that's going on. Here's the mathematical idea. Here's where the mathematics gets in. In primitive animals, there are things called central pattern generators. And if you look in at lamprey eels, there are particular neurons in the nervous system that spike in exactly the same rhythm as the motion of the animal. Now, with mammals, it's not clear that there is a central pattern generator, but there's a lot of secondary evidence that there might be. Being a mathematician, I can just say, well, let there be a central pattern generator, and now ask, well, if there were a central pattern generator, what kind of structure would it have? to be able to produce rhythms of walk, trot, and pace. Just do that, limit the amount of information. So let's design the simplest network of differential equations, which will produce rhythms of walk, trot, and pace. And we know what that means because we can translate that into spatiotemporal symmetries. We can look for solutions with the right symmetry class. Well, the way I like to say this is you do the obvious and it doesn't work, then you know you're onto something. And so let me tell you what I believe to be the obvious and try to explain to you why it won't work. Suppose I imagine that the nervous system has four neurons or four groups of neurons, and each group of neurons controls one leg. Reasonable. Is there a way that I can sort of couple the system together with the right symmetries so that I can get walk, trot, and pace? And the answer is no if you want the gaits to be truly different. And so let me try to explain what I mean. Suppose the network produces a walk. Remember, the walk symmetry was left rear to left front to right rear to right front. And with that, you get a quarter period phase shift. So the system of differential equations, in order to have this as a robust motion, more or less has to have this symmetry in it. So the symmetry is left rear to left front, right rear, right front. Now, suppose that this system, besides producing a walk, can also produce a pace. And I've indicated this by 1 and 3 are synchronous, 2 and 4 are synchronous. That is, the left legs are synchronous, the right legs are synchronous. Apply the walk symmetry. 1 goes to 3, 3 goes to 2. Now 3 and 2 are synchronous, and of course 1 and 4 are synchronous. That is, from the pace, applying the walk symmetry, you get a trot. So the interesting fact, what I've just proved here, is that if you want, if these things were just symmetrically related, then their stability properties would be the same. If you got this dog into the trot, into the pace, thing, it would continue into the pace. It wouldn't go over to the trot if those were symmetrically related gaits. So what this proves in a sort of strange way, I could have differential equations represented in 1, 2, 3, and 4, which are each a million dimensional. And yet, if there were just four of these identical things trying to give you the walk, trot, or pace, you won't be able to get them as different gaits. So we said, okay, let's go back and use the symmetries that we know that should be in the central pattern generator, namely the four cycle having to do with walk, order of four symmetry, and the transposition, the bilateral symmetry that's associated with pace or trot, and write down the simplest network which has both of those symmetries present. And you get this double ring, 1 to 3 to 5 to 7 back to 1, 2 to 4 to 6 to 8 back to 2, and they're symmetric across that bilateral symmetry. So that's the two symmetries are built into this network. And we ask, well, can we get walk, trot, and pace out of this? And the answer is yes. You get walk, trot, and pace, and by that I mean these will be transitions from a stand. You imagine a state where all four legs are just fixed, same thing, and now you want to translate to this oscillation, you start walking. Well, you can get walk, trot, and pace. And by the by, you also get bound and pronk. And this is where things start to get interesting. So far, you can say, well, you're just getting out what you knew. You also get a gait, which we called the jump, because we didn't know what else. No one that we talked to had ever heard of this thing. The horse, comes down, front legs hit unison. A quarter period later, the rear legs hit, and then it takes three quarters of a period for the front legs to come back down. So we started thinking of this as a jump. Now, Ivers mentioned that I spent a lot of time in Houston, and what you may not know about Houston, Texas, is that the highlight of the cultural season is the Houston Livestock and Rodeo Show. And Ian Stewart was visiting, and we went to the rodeo.
So well,
thanks.
You say it as well as Pete Hawkins rides. 80 big points. Here's one of the two leaders tied.
I had this instant replay, and here it is in slow motion. front back, wait a while, front back, wait a while. It's still a little hard. Okay, so we had this idea, having the film. Okay, stop.
Enough of you.
Let's look at the frame-by-frame analysis. At frame 62 in that clip that I just showed you, the front legs of the horse hit the ground. At frame 75, the rear legs hit the ground. And it's not until frame 109 that the front legs hit the ground again. Then we did something sort of scientific. We took the lengths of this salmon-colored thing and averaged those, and the lengths of the blue thing, and took the ratio. Well, the ratio of salmon to blue would be 1 if it were a bound, and 3 if it were this jump gate. And for a non-scientific experiment, this is incredibly close to 3. So what we're seeing is that we don't know whether there's a central pattern generator, but we can infer some of its properties from what we actually see as the gates, from the gates that we observe, and from that start to put together information about what the animals seem to do, which is sort of curious. Now, there's one thing that I haven't said much about, this 8-cell system that I put here. What we imagined is that each leg received signals from 2 different cells. And you ask, well, why in the world would you need 2 signals when 1 should suffice? Although the little argument that I showed you before says that 1 will not suffice. So we decided after a while to not look at something so complicated as a quadruped, but go back to us, bipeds, and say, well, if we had a biped central pattern generator, it would have 2 cells sending its signal to the left leg and 2 cells sending its signal to the right leg. And let's see what this system produces. Well, the first thing that you notice from a mathematical point of view is that there are 2 different gates for biped, such that when you swap left and right legs, you're a half a period out of phase. So in one of those gates, the prediction is both signals going to the left leg will be in synchrony, and in the other, they'll be a half period out of phase. So, well, is there more than one gate for bipeds where you have half a period out of phase? Well, almost everybody here has run at some time in their life. Walking and running are anatomically different gates. When you walk, you're more or less moving your leg as a pendulum. Okay, that's... When you run, your quadrupeds are the ones that are giving you the force, and you're putting your leg up and down. It's sort of like a pogo stick, and that's the way it's described. Now, how can, when you're walking and your leg goes back and forth, well, you're not just standing here on the other leg, you're trying to get forward, so you put your leg down and your foot rotates through. That is, if you look at the ankle, joint, the ankle joint must be rotating, whereas if you look at the pogo stick type gait, you're holding your ankle rigid. That's the way you go up and down. And to first order approximation. Well, now you realize that joints are controlled by 2 muscle groups. The only things that muscles can do are basically pull. So you need, in order to get things to work, you have to have them pull in 2 different directions. These are called flexors and extensors. I like to call them push and pull, but then I'm not much of an anatomist. In the case of the ankle joint, these are gastrocnemius and tibialis anterior. I studied hard to be able to pronounce them. And people have done experiments where they've looked at people walking and running, and indeed, when you are running, the 2 you can get electrical signals from these muscle groups. You find that they're more or less co-activated. And when you're walking, they're more or less out of phase. So here's a symmetry distinction between walk and run, and it also explains why you need two signals going to each leg, because the theorem is, in order to have walk, trot, and pace as different gaits and quadrupeds, you have to have muscles. Well, okay, you're supposed to laugh. The point is, you must have these. It is indicative of the fact that of the way motion is set by legs that you have these different muscle groups, and that's the sort of thing which must be controlled. Okay, so now Ivers showed this copy of the book Symmetry and Chaos. Let me try to show you that even with much more complicated dynamics, patterns appear, and that they have some relation to things that you see in the physical world. So here, this mapping F is going to be a mapping of the plane to the plane. It's a rule which says if you take a point in the plane, it tells you where to take that point. Okay, I could write down a formula for some such mapping, but you get the idea. Just every point in the plane goes by to another point in the plane. Now, suppose I choose a point Z naught and I apply F to it. I get another point, which I'll call Z1. And I take Z1, apply F to it, I get another point Z2. And this way, I get what mathematicians would call a dynamical system. Points just move around the plane in sequence. And we started saying, well, what happens if this F has some symmetry? What would you expect to see? The first thing is that there are this notion of attractors. That is, you iterate the mapping, that's what we're doing here, apply the F lots of times. On a computer, do 1,000 iterates, throw them away, and then plot the next million iterates. And what you see is what's called an attractor. It's a loose definition, but it will do. Okay. Now, suppose we take in the plane, look at the kinds of symmetries that you could have. Well, you could have the symmetries of a triangle, a square, or a pentagon. And for the square, there are 8 symmetries of the square. There's, first of all, the symmetry which is like zero, do nothing. That's rotate angle zero. I could rotate by 90 degrees, 180, or 270 degrees. So that's 4 symmetries. Or I can reflect along these 4 axes. That's another 4. So there are 8 symmetries. For the pentagon, there will be 10 symmetries. For the triangle, there are 6. Clear what's going on. Now, to say that a mapping has symmetry means that it satisfies this formula. So first of all, let me remind you, an odd function is one on the line which takes f of minus x is minus f of x. That is, if I take x and minus x, which are symmetrically related around the origin, and apply f to it, it will go to a pair of points which themselves are symmetrically related. Well, this is the same formula, but now with any of the symmetries, let's say if I took the symmetries of the pentagon, so there would be 10 symmetries that this f needs to satisfy in this way. And there's a way, it's called invariant theory, to write down formulas, and the easiest thing is if you let z be a complex number, which is in the plane, then you can actually write down a formula which has this dm symmetry. And then you can say, well, let me choose a symmetry, so I'll choose m equal to 5, pentagonal symmetry, and I'll choose constants here. You know, here's just a couple set of constants. And now for each of these, I'm going to iterate this map and do what I just said. Iterate 1,000 times, throw it away, and then iterate a few million times and plot the result. Well, this is when you know, again, you're on to something. Your favorite Rorschach test, I think you would come up with a pretty good schematic for a sand dollar. Now, there's something that's going on here that I didn't describe. This is color. This has colors. So let me use the second set of numbers to tell you what the colors mean. So Mike Field called this the emperor's cloak. What we did here is iterate for 251 million iterates. and count the number of times each pixel on the screen is hit during this iteration process, and color by number. So this two pixels having the same color on the screen is saying that the probability that you'll land in those pixels during the iteration process is the same. So the colors, the different colors, are indicating different probabilities. Now, if you look down here, there's white, and next to it, dark blue. Well, white is hit just one or two times during the iteration process. Dark blue is hit 600 times. So there's an incredible structure to what's going on here. That is, that this picture is reproducible. I'll guarantee you this is chaotic dynamics, and I'll try to explain why in a few minutes. And you've probably heard of the butterfly effect. If anybody has heard about chaos, they've heard of the butterfly effect. I mean, my own feeling is that it's nonsense. But let me try to explain why I think that it's nonsense. Is it a true mathematical statement? Yes. It's the interpretation of the mathematical statement that I don't like. It is true that if a butterfly flaps its wings outside the carriage house, it will snow tomorrow in Beijing, quite unexpectedly, that's a possible outcome. But it's not really likely that it's going to make that kind of a change. The average expectations is something which is reproducible. And that's what these pictures are saying, is that the average, the times that you hit a given point is really something which is a reproducible effect. Now, that third picture, the third set of parameter values leads to this. And since this is a political season, we had called this the Pentagon attractor. Now, I want you to look carefully and ask how the mathematics, you see this figure up here? He's either a white knight saving the world, or it's Darth Vader. You can decide which. Again, you start to see these pictures appearing, and it's really quite remarkable. I promised to show you that these were chaos, chaotic dynamics. Chaotic dynamics is the basic definition is what's called sensitive dependence on initial conditions, and that's really what the butterfly effect is supposed to be. That is, if you take two points that are nearby, after a while they're uncorrelated. Well, I can give you, using this threefold symmetric picture, a way of seeing that this is going to be the case. So it has threefold symmetry. Here are the three lines of symmetry. You have these six wedges, which I will color blue, green, red, magenta, and so on. And now, on this side, take a point over here and ask where it goes on one iterate of the map that produced this picture of gold Flintstone. It'll go over to this red wedge. Over here, this point will go to the green wedge. This point will go to the blue wedge. And you can start to see from this schematic how the mapping is mixing up points in the plane. Well, this is just one iterate. Remember, we did 250 million, that kind of thing. So after three iterates, points over here go to magenta, points here, green, blue. You can start to see that points that are relatively near are going to different wedges. Well, after nine iterations, it's really starting to get mixed up. But just after 29, this is really impressively mixed. And now you imagine just doing this millions and millions of times. So this shows that there is indeed sensitive dependence on initial conditions. Just a few more Rorschach tests for your amusement. This is our chaotic flower, St. John's wort, which, if you look it up, cured an incredible number of things in 15th century England. We tried to get Mercedes interested, but another threefold symmetric. Now, you can do the same thing with using periodic boundary conditions, and you can make quilts. So this is the same kind of deal on a hexagon where it's periodic on the boundaries. And you really have to wonder where, how the mathematics is coming up with these kinds of pictures. Remember, equal, same color, equal probability of visitation. My favorite is this one, which certainly looks like a mosaic that one could create out of just in stone. Now, I want to go back to the physics and biology. Do these pictures tell you anything about what's going on in experiments? Let me try to describe a way of translating this chaotic dynamic pictures to something that's in fluid dynamics. I imagine I'm doing an experiment and watching the concentration of a certain element inside a fluid at a point in space, at a point in time. So this will be my U of XT, I'll call it a time series. That is, it gives me a value of the concentration at every point in space and time. Now, there's something in mathematics called the ergodic theorem, and I'm going to try to simplify it for you. Time averages equal space averages. If you integrate something in time, you'll get the same value if you integrate it over space. Well, this is a simplification. But it gives you an idea of what's going that there is some interesting things about chaotic dynamics that you can still get your hands on. So if I take the time average and find symmetries, it will be the same symmetries as what was in the symmetries of the attractor. The space average would have those symmetries. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to look at an experiment, take a time average, and see what kind of symmetries it has. And the experiment that I want to use is something called the Faraday surface wave experiment. You take a fluid, it's also called the coffee cup experiment. Imagine that you're on a train and you have a fluid layer. And as you're bumping along, the fluid layer, that's the cup of coffee, is going up and down. And now it's a fact that if the amplitude of vibration is very small, then the fluid will remain flat. But if the amplitude of vibration becomes larger, then you start getting surface waves appearing. And that's why Faraday suggested this as a possible experimental situation. The way the experiments are done in modern setting, you take a speaker, and you just put the fluid layer on the speaker and let it vibrate. And you can get different frequencies, obviously different tones, and you can control the volume, which controls the amplitude of the forcing. Now, the physicists are very clever. They take a camera and look up from the bottom, and the surface, if it's deformed, is going to either diffuse light or focus it. And then they take a picture on top, and that gives you something which is called a shadow graph. So it has light and dark regions, and this tells you something about what the surface wave looked like or is. So here's the kind of surface wave that you would see. This is experiments done by Jerry Golub and co-workers, and it's a square container. This is the transition, what happens just after the fluid, the flat surface loses stability and you go to this kind of a picture. Very much the square symmetry that you see. But this is it's not exactly a stationary state. If you take a picture, what's called a stroboscopic picture, every period of the forcing, take a picture, then this will, black and white will interchange. So every second period, you'll get the same picture back again. Now, what happens if you increase the amplitude of the forcing? Well, here I don't have a movie. But if I did, what you would see is that, first of all, the cellular structure has kind of broken down, and these things will just move around all over the place. Dare I use the word chaotically? Certainly in a complicated manner. So, a prediction. If you time average the intensity of the transmitted light at every point in space, then you should get a picture which is symmetric. And this is exactly what happens. So the symmetry, the broken symmetry, it's disappeared, reoccurs in time averages. So it's an interesting way of going from those pretty pictures of the plane with the Rorschach test to something which you can actually measure in experiments. Okay, and now it's getting late. There's a few minutes left. And I thought I would end with something which is a lot more fun, geometric visual hallucinations. There's a study which, unfortunately, NSF will no longer fund, which has to do with taking hallucinogenic drugs. And, Heinrich Kluber, some years ago, did a lot of experimentation. I think much of it was self-experimentation. And after he found that when he ingested certain drugs, that he would get a geometric image, which he then drew. And in fact, if you go to the library, you would be incredulous. The number of books that have pictures of hallucinations, hallucinatory experiences that people have compiled. And Heinrich Kluber made the observation, he felt, that these patterns fell into four different classes, those which he called tunnels and funnels and spirals, and then lattices, which include honeycombs and phosphenes, and cobwebs. So in case you've forgotten what these look like, these are the tunnels and the funnels and spirals. And the honeycombs and phosphenes. Now, I know that nobody has seen any of these before, but if you want in the last few minutes to have your own private hallucinatory experience, if you cover your eyeball with your finger and keep it there for a little while, I am told you will start to see the phosphenes. But I'm not going to, I take no responsibility for this. The honeycomb came from marijuana. And then there are the cobwebs, which are not just what you see after you wake up. If you look at petroglyphs, a lot of these patterns appear. And there's some suggestion that the reason they appear is because of certain weeds that were growing in the area. These patterns do repeat themselves. So here's a kind of pattern formation. And what can you say? Well, Jack Cowan and Bart Ehrmantraut in around 1980 came up with this idea that let's look at the primary visual cortex. This is the thing on your head when you, it's just at the back. If you drill in, the first thing you'll hit is the primary visual cortex brain. It's about 40 millimeters by 40 millimeters. And suggestion is that the drug uniformly stimulates the primary visual cortex. So what the cortex consists of neurons. Imagine a state, what are neurons doing? They're spiking, they're doing some electrical activity. Assume that they're all just doing the same thing at the moment. And now the drug comes in, just like in the convection experiment, it forces the system to create patterns on the cortex. Then what would you see in your mind if a pattern formed? And the idea is what you would see is the geometric shape in the outside world, which would give you the same pattern on the cortex. Now, remarkably, there is a way to go from the cortex to the outside world. There are experiments which show that a certain function, the complex logarithm, will be the way to transmit. The technically inclined, there's a unique angle-forming map from a little square patch, that's the cortex, to a circle, which preserves the density of neurons in each place. So in the eyes, neurons fall off 1 over r squared, the density from the fovea, the center part, and in the cortex, they're uniform. And this is the unique mapping that does this. And it's been, there are a number of experiments which suggest that this is the right thing to look at. Now, if you look at the cortex, you think of it as just these neurons firing, this is like a planar layer. So what I should expect to come on the cortex are these stripes and spots that we were talking about right at the beginning of the talk. And those spots and stripes, the stripes, when you project them into the outside world by this complex logarithm function, will give you these two pictures. You can also get the phosphenes in this way. These are actually spots on the cortex. But the honeycomb and cobwebs don't seem to have any anything that matches up with what's on the from this kind of pattern formation. Well, what Paul Breslov with Jack Cowan observed is that, of course, the cortex has much more structure than just a bunch of neurons that are all the same. And let me try to explain what that structure is. There are neurons in the cortex which are sensitive to orientations in the outside world. That is, this neuron here, wherever this is, in this blue region, the color is not important, corresponds to seeing a little line in the outside world, which is northwest to southeast. This yellow is northeast to southwest. Red is horizontal, and so on. So the cortex is well known to have these the neurons have these orientation preferences. And Hubel and Wiesel got a Nobel Prize for work that included the observation that in a small patch of the cortex, let's say about a millimeter by a millimeter, there will be neurons that want to fire, that are sensitive to all possible orientations. And that millimeter by millimeter is roughly the sensitivity of a single area in space where you can resolve the resolution capacity of the eye. So suppose you build into this model the orientation tuning of the cortex. Well, in a way, how do you build it in? There's another thing which is called anisotropy. That is, people wanted to know what kinds of, what was the connectivity of neurons in the cortex. So they put a little, they drop some dye in, and it gets picked up by some neurons and comes out somewhere else. And it suggests that neurons here are connected to neurons there. Neurons in this blue area, well, in fact, where the dye is coming out, this is in the green, almost all of the dye is coming out in the green areas. This is suggesting that the long-range connections in the cortex are between neurons that want to fire in the same direction, with the same orientation sensitivity. And this is with the monkey, with the tree shrew, it's the same sort of thing, but it's even more pronounced. The dye is put in here in this blue area, and you see it. And not only that, the connections are not uniform around. Not all the blue areas are getting it, only in a certain direction. This is the anisotropy. This certain direction is called the visiotopic axis and actually corresponds to the direction in the outside world which these neurons are sensitive to. So now try to build a model based on symmetry. The symmetries are different, where they act differently in such a model than they do in the planar case that I was talking about at the beginning of the talk. We can do the symmetry breaking analysis. You can write down the kinds of solutions that you would get, the kinds of patterns. So let me remind you, here's the visual hallucinations that came from the experiments. And here are best of class pictures, admittedly, that come from the mathematics. So there's something going on here. To say that we know what's going on would be a gross overstatement, but this does seem to suggest that the mathematics is this abstraction of a perfectly symmetric situation, which it's not in the cortex, is still giving us some information about the structure and what the system can do. And this will continue for quite a while to understand things like these patterns better. So, a couple of conclusions. patterns that appear in physical and biological systems often have their genesis in symmetry, and that symmetric patterns that appear can appear in much different physics and biological situations as long as the same symmetry and they act in the same way. Then you can see the same kinds of patterns appear. That's it. Thank you.